Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Increment Vice. The podcast that explores Paul Thomas Anderson's inherent vice, one scene at a time, with your host, Travis Woods. Raymond Chandler once wrote, "The French have a phrase for it. The bastards have a phrase for everything. And they're always right. To say goodbye is to die a little." As we begin to make our long goodbyes, that's something to think about, isn't it? Maybe that's why it's so hard to let go of what's lost. It feels like dying a little. Just ask our old pal, Bigfoot Bjornsson.
I'd like to start today by reading two passages from my guest's new book, Paul Thomas Anderson, Masterworks, an absolutely staggering monograph which drops this week, and I highly recommend all of you read, like, immediately. Both of these passages, I think, rather neatly capture the spirit of inherent vice in general and today's scene in specific. And the first goes like this. "Few directors are as fascinated by the spectacle of carefully maintained facades crumbling as Paul Thomas Anderson. Breakdowns are Anderson's specialty. In light of his fixation with physical and psychological deterioration, it's no wonder he eventually made a film called Inherent Vice." And the second passage. "The eruptive side of Anderson's films, their eccentric outbursts and erratic ellipses, their wild detours and leaps of faith, can plausibly be celebrated or dismissed as showmanship, but it also expresses a fundamental understanding of inherent vice that the center cannot hold. If in the long view, his films stand up, whether as examples of ingenious and enduring engineering, glittering edifices to artistic self-regard, or markers of both their actual and imagined time and place, it is paradoxically because of their acknowledgement, so achingly direct in places, or else lurking in the corners of the frame and the backs of our minds, that nothing is ever built to last." Oof, goddamn, that's the good stuff. And as I said, those are passages from a book that drops this week entitled Paul Thomas Anderson, Masterworks. And joining me today is its author, a critic, writer, and lecturer. Today's guest teaches cinema studies at the University of Toronto, is a contributing editor to CinemaScope, and reviews films for The Ringer, Sight and Sound, and Little White Lies. Mr. Adam Naiman, thanks for coming on today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Nothing more self-conscious than hearing your own prose read back to you, and you're like, "Boy, that's a long sentence." I had a friend, actually, one of my friends who was one of my readers on the book very early on. She sent me this note and she goes, Are your sentences so long and complex? Because Anderson's got these long, complex tracking shots, and I'm like, no, but that's really good.
That's a good idea. Yeah, you should have said yes. Should have rolled with that.
No, I'll just use it. I'll just use it going forward. But no, I'm delighted to be here.
And I am sure you're excited to think about something that you haven't thought much about at all, which is a film made by Paul Thomas Anderson. I'm sure you're not exhausted in the least.
You think you're being sardonic, but I'll tell you something. The book was finished in about mid-February, mid-March, signed off on, because it's a big, physically large book and, you know, very elaborately printed and designed. So actually, since March, except for all the stuff I'm doing to get ready to promote it, it's been a PTA free zone, you know. So actually, and I mean this with what we're talking on today, and so other things I've been invited to do, it's actually been delightful to pick back up and think about the movies, because I kind of detoxed.
Well, what's it like to come back to them after such an intense period of study and immersion? And then have that kind of clean break and then return to them, because I feel like that's something that'll probably, I'm almost reaching out to you in a therapist sense, like, tell me what it's going to be like, because there's this episode and then there's one more. It's going to be, I will have done a 45 episode breakdown of Inherent Vice. And then I'm going to walk away for a while. I'm going to walk away and I'm curious what it's going to be like. Have I ruined this movie for myself, or what is it going to be like for me when I come back to it? Like, what's it been like for you to re-immerse in these films?
I think that whether it's choosing a 45 episode podcast or a 300 page book, you're choosing material that, at least for your own personal taste, you know, it's level of inherent vice is probably minimal. You know, it's something that we're choosing, subject or a movie or a filmmaker that we don't think is going to disintegrate. For us, it's going to sort of remain solid.
Sure.
You know, and I think that one of the best ways to test your love or your fandom or your admiration or your commitment to something is to really test it, you know? I mean, I think that in Anderson's case, it was harder to return while writing the book, harder to return to the earlier films for a bunch of reasons. I like them less. They're very connected on an adolescent level, just time of life. And, you know, if you've read the book, this book is not about me at all. I mean, there's nothing about me and my relationship to movies, which is a valid way to talk about films in books and podcasts and conversation. But, you know, Boogie Nights and Magnolia were things I saw when I was a teenager, and they are inextricably linked to those sensations, even if it's not what's in the movie. For me, it was the life.
Yeah.
Where the later films are also tied to parts of my life, but I like those later films more, and maybe I like those later parts of my life more, or I'm happier to relate to them because they're not at this point, you know, 25 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever. You know, so now coming back to a film like Inherent Vice doesn't actually feel that hard, because I think by the time I saw that, the year it came out in, I was already kind of in my 30s. Not quite a dad yet, but like kind of in the house where I'm living now, like it doesn't feel like a hard thing to reclaim. And it's not a hard movie to watch, you know?
It's a very
chill watch.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you
know, with a lot of stuff going on in its heart.
With a ton of stuff going on. And it was one of two chapters in the book that I felt I really had to nail that precise inversion maybe of seriousness, where it's not severe on the surface, but because of the literary source and because of the cultural period, I wanted to get a lot of what it's kind of getting at right. This chapter and the master chapter were the ones where I sort of thought I really want to do right by the sociocultural undergirding of this material. Doesn't mean I didn't care in the other chapters, but it felt crucial, which is why in the way I tried to look at the film in the context of even just that opening epigram, you know, under the paving stones of the beach, and try and deconstruct where that came from, and you know, it's the revolutionary Parisian context in which it was formulated, and how Pynchon uses that and how Anderson uses that. You know, I just wanted to get it right.
And tying that, again, I was telling you before we began recording how many moments in this book I was driven to anger, not out of disagreement, but in that feeling of, oh, God damn it, I should have thought of that. And one of my favorite bits of business is at the very beginning of the Vice chapter, in which you connect that revolutionary French slogan, you know, under the paving stones, the beach, to the essentially the sigh of Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi, when she has the line, which was written in 1970, the same year in which In Hair of Ice is set, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot.
Yeah, which the sentiment in reverse,
which could literally, it could have been such an appropriate tagline for this film. Like they paved paradise and put up a parking lot is that's inherent vice. That is the definition of inherent vice in so many ways. And that, again, just minor aside, that was one of those moments where I was very happy to only have the book in PDF form and not my hard copy yet, because I would have thrown it across the room. I was so annoyed at you having come up with that.
Also, my flip side to that was, while writing it, I didn't have the scene in front of me. I was like, when Shasta leaves, does she get in a big yellow taxi? Because if she does, I'm going to have to, I have a license to print money. And of course, it's her own car. You know, I didn't really think it was a taxi, but you know, it's funny too how when you go through a movie, I mean, there's that Pauline Kael line, you know, she only watches a movie once. And the fact that some of her reviews were so persuasive and detailed obviously indicated that she took notes, that she had a good memory. Of course, also that meant that she sometimes, and this is not about shitting on Pauline Kael at all, that's like a different podcast. But you know, there were sometimes lots of details, narrative details, visual details, dialogue details. Yeah. When you go through her reviews, because of that stubbornness, and also because this was pre-VHS DVD reviewing, sure, she got them wrong. So it's interesting with Inherent Vice, when you go back to a movie and rewatch it, it really actually can kind of clash with your, not just your memories of it, but like even things you'd written about it before. Because I wrote a bit about Inherent Vice for a magazine called Cineast when the movie came out, just a straight review. I was going back to that to kind of take some of the observations from it and reconfigure them. And just a couple of little things in that review kind of clashed with the movie that I was watching. Like, they're the viewing equivalent of factual errors. And the point of a book, which is in print and which has a long, long editing process, is you can't have space for those. Yeah. The good part is it lets you feel and seem like you're really smart, because you're catching up on details that readers have surely forgotten. And then pulling those details out for the readers, and they're like, oh man, I got to watch the movie again. The best compliment that anyone can give for the kind of close reading writing that I do, with the Coen Brothers book, I got this a lot, where people are like, that made me want to watch that scene again. Yeah. Which is why I love the subject of your podcast, because it's so fine-grained and fine-tuned. We're not having a general discussion about Inherent Vice, though we are. We're going into a specific scene, and you know, if we're going to talk about a two-minute scene, we got to be precise.
Exactly. And there's something about, and I think The Master is this way too. And that's why I like that you group them earlier when you're talking about, you know, how you wanted to do them both justice. There is something about their kind of ghostly nature I think all the more appropriate for Inherent Vice, which is about the idea of Inherent Vice, which inherently renders things somewhat ghostly and kind of hard to grasp. That weirdly, and this is going to be a clumsy way of putting it, Inherent Vice is a hard film to remember as it is. Remember it exactly. There's something about its structure, about its pace, about the way the scenes are built, about the way the ideas are deployed, that it does kind of play almost like a stoner fugue state. That when, I'm sure like you, I have seen this film many more times than is healthy or is normal. And yet there are still moments where when I'm rewatching it, where I'll be like, I totally forgot this scene existed, or that this happens in this order. There's something about the film that almost kind of disorders the brain from remembering it just as it happened, which is kind of in keeping with the entirety of the film's thematics, is the way that you will look at it with rose-colored glasses. And then when you watch it again, in reality, you're like, oh man, this is a downer. This is way darker and scarier than I remember the film being.
I'll try and keep this to a controlled length, but it's an interesting sort of talking point with him, because with There Will Be Blood, that's a movie that is not only much more hard cut in memory, where it's almost designed to be remembered because the dialogue and the angles and just the incidents are so memorable, but that's also a movie that is fully concrete and right up in your face until it gets elliptical and you have that jump cut towards the end, which is my favorite moment in any Anderson film. The kids jumping
off. That 15-year cut.
Yeah. And that ellipticism then, I think, is more imbued in The Master, in Inherent Vice, where it's not like his focus or his concentration or his specificity as a filmmaker vanish, but as you say, he begins trusting this more ephemeral sort of, you know, barely, barely visible connective tissue sometimes between the scenes. And it's one thing if he's imposing that choice, but he's not. I think he's finding it in the material. And when he comes back to Phantom Thread, he's right back to that kind of bravura showmanship, and it's pretty tight. You know, I'm not saying Phantom Thread's not mysterious, but its mysteries are underneath a really easily discernible, memorable romantic drama plotline. Yeah. But the Master and Inherent Vice are somewhat, they feel disordered. They feel like fugues, you know? And in both cases, even though they're quite different movies, there's a lot between them. There's Joaquin Phoenix between them. There's the setting. There's the mid-century or mid to late 20th century kind of vibe. And kind of cults and cults of personality and lost souls, they're a nice pair.
They are. I do think that they are the, I think that on the surface, initially, when I tell people that the best PTA double feature you could ever watch is The Master and Inherent Vice, you know, there's, you get that cocked eyebrow of just like, but no, one is so serious and one is just so goofy. But no, they really are speaking to each other, whether it's about, whether it's the fact that they are kind of two films about how, you know, PTA kind of, during the press cycle for Inherent Vice, when people were like, well, what is this? What the hell is this? What is this about? And he's like, oh, it's just about how badly, you know, you can miss that one old lady that you know isn't right for you, but you still miss her. Which isn't that Master to Freddie Quill, or isn't that Freddie Quill to Master? They're just that one that you know you want to be with, but there's just, you don't know how to make it work because they're so troublesome or problematic or cause such disarray and chaos in your world. And I do think that more than any of the other groupings of films in his filmography, those two so speak to one another. And it's almost like they make me think a bit of the Radiohead Kid A and Amnesiac relationship, where Inherent Vice almost feels like he just wasn't done exploring those ideas completely. He had just like a little bit more gas left in the tank than, and wasn't able to get it all out in The Master. And that Inherent Vice is like this very, very extended epilogue to that story, which is appropriate because that's, I think, a big part of The Master is about that inability to totally let go. It comes with this 2.5 hour epilogue of not letting go.
Yeah, and definitely it captures him, I think, at a moment of commitment to an actor where, you know, you kind of have in the last four Anderson films these little actor, you know, diptychs, you know, with the two Day-Lewis movies and the two Phoenix movies. I think he uses Day-Lewis extremely differently in Phantom Thread than in There Will Be Blood. And there's time in between those movies, which suggests a kind of changed perspective. Whereas in terms of how Phoenix functions in the two movies back to back, it's not that the performances are similar, but the way he uses it as an actor, I think, is similar, where any sense that these movies are about yearning or dissatisfaction or curiosity or something out of reach is keyed completely to the kind of acting style that Joaquin Phoenix has. Good performances, bad performances, good movies, bad movies. I think one of Phoenix's trademarks is he never has it together, right? You know, and that's not
true. No, it's very true.
It's not making fun of him. And maybe the essence of conflict when you're going to have character studies is characters don't have it together, because movies about characters who have it together are boring. But he's not even ever playing a guy who like goes to pieces. He always plays a guy who starts in pieces.
That's a good point.
He does. I mean, I guess if you go through the filmography, there's probably exceptions. I mean, like one exception is in We Own the Night, where that guy actually kind of does have his shit together as a black sheep. And then by becoming a cop, he fucks his life up. But a lot of the time, you know, Phoenix plays these kind of wrecks. And I love the difference too between the alcoholic wreck that he is in The Master and the pot that he's in Inherent Vice. Inherent Vice is a mellower movie because weed is mellower than booze. I mean, in The Master, he's not functional. In Inherent Vice, he's compromised, but he can dress himself, you know?
He makes a pretty good disguise now and then.
Pardon me?
And he makes a pretty good disguise now and then.
Yeah, does. You know, I mean, I love both performances. I think the Inherent Vice performance is less showy.
Yeah. Well, it's a far more reactive performance because, and I think the interesting line that he straddles in that film or in Inherent Vice is that he, in a way, he's playing a very defined character, but at the same time, he's also having to play us and be constantly befuddled and confused. Like, there's never a moment where Doc is ahead of us in the film. Like, he is just at our level where he's, you know, the first time anyone's watching that movie and you're like, who? Okay, so there's a Nazi real estate developer, and so there's some dentists, and okay, and there's a girl that he's missing. And it just his constant state of befuddlement, I think, is meant to kind of, you know, I don't know if I would call him an audience surrogate, but he is kind of playing our confusion and embodying our confusion in that film, which,
well, yeah, I think for sure. And I think that for a certain audience, part of that audience, which is not you or I, but let's say people who are 20 years older than we are, and this doesn't have anything to do with Pynchon or even with Anderson, but it has to do with the period. I think he is playing the audience to some extent. It's maybe not the audience that Inherent Vice was aimed at in terms of trying to turn a profit, but people with lived experience and memories of that time, I think, will be inside certain things that performance gets out, especially the idea. And this is the only place where I think it's really similar to The Big Lebowski, which is one of my favorite movies ever. Obviously, I wrote a book on the Coens, and it's not about comparing things. I'm not going to like rank Inherent Vice below something on your Inherent Vice podcast, but I do love The Lebowski. But what I think it has in common with Lebowski is the idea of, like, not just befuddlement, but, you know, the dude is a non-professional investigator. He doesn't really have the skill set. And so in a way, what allows him to put things together is more just luck and really his own morality. I mean, that's the joke of The Big Lebowski, is he's like one of the only nice people. I mean, that when you say it out loud, it sounds dumb. Like, he has concern for the missing girl, but it's not personal, it's moral, you know? Yeah. And what's interesting about Doc is he actually has a skill set as an investigator. He's good at it. It's just the forces that he's arrayed against are so abstract and so dispersed. I mean, Lebowski's plot, and this is the genius of that movie, makes perfect sense. It's just that the dude's dumb. The plot of it, I mean, and with a different investigator, you put Humphrey Bogart in The Big Lebowski, the movie's over in 2 minutes.
Exactly.
You know, in Inherent Vice, it's really, really genuinely hard to follow, and it's not just Doc's fault. It's that the tentacles, the tendrils of corruption are just so dispersed across this civic landscape. It's not Doc's fault. It's pretty hard to figure out what the hell is going on.
Or if not just hard, it's that, as you said, the tendrils are so dispersed that everything you're looking at is the Golden Fang. There's, when you're looking at any vista in Los Angeles, there's no part that's untouched. So it's hard to see, because you can't see where the evil begins and ends, because it is so all-encompassing. There's no outline to see it against. There's no part of goodness to delineate where the Golden Fang begins and goodness ends.
And I'm glad you said that, because it lets me loop back to the point that I quite Doc-like just lost, that I was trying to make about the film's audience, which is, I think, for people who live inside that deflated sense of principle, or who maybe remember before they paved paradise. I mean, the whole point of Joni Mitchell's song is that it's an eternal condition. And, you know, we shrink it to our own experience where it's like, well, you know, my boyfriend left me, so, you know, God is dead, or, you know, Eden's gone. But, you know, for people who believe there was a time before they paved paradise and put up a parking lot, or people had their own little personal paradise, whether it was literally, you know, Gordita Beach or some version of it, I think that the movie is quite sad. I think that for people who are watching it, who were around in that time and who were sympathetic to that lifestyle or parts of that lifestyle, it's probably a pretty anguishing experience, whereas you and I are approaching it more historiographically or anthropologically or ethnographically, like, oh, that's a thing that happened that I know from culture.
Sure.
But not living in it, through it.
And yet you can still, the emotional connection still resonates. And maybe part of that is just because for people of our generation, we've just been so spoon-fed the importance of the 60s and their passing as being kind of the snapping of the American soul in some way, which it wasn't. But, you know, for the boomers and baby boomers that came before us, for them, that was, you know, I remember Don DeLillo calling, like, they say the assassination of Kennedy is like, that's the moment that broke the back of the American dream. And so we've been so kind of spoon-fed the narrative of the 60s being the end of American goodness that you can almost by proxy be hit by the emotional heft of the sociopolitical aspects of this movie, even if you're not, you know, Thomas Pynchon and sitting and looking back very angrily at that time that you were young and could have done something. But I also think that by attaching that and really digging far deeper than Pynchon ever did in the book into connecting that era's passing with the passing of a romantic relationship, then it does become something that those of us who are sitting there like, oh my God, my boyfriend or girlfriend left me, God is dead, can very much latch on and go, God damn, this really is what it's like to just to let go of someone, or not, or rather to be unable to let go of someone who's let go of you. And there's a universal quality to that, despite being such an odd and ghostly film. And I think it's the same reason that The Master resonates so deeply for those that for whom it can resonate, because I know there's I think these are the two films that are the most in some ways alienating of PTA's works, but I think for those of us, you know, who can find that emotional core, they're two very, very, very heartbreaking, very, very poignant films that kind of speak to what it can be like to long and yearn for someone.
For sure. And in The Master, I'm of the mind that while everything you say is true, that's very well said. The other level that the movie exists on is quite comic, which is it's the eternal story of the erotomaniac who can't get laid, which is where in some ways there's a similarity, not socially or culturally or in terms of the part of America that's being depicted, but I always think of it as His Eyes Wide Shut, even more than I think of Phantom Thread as His Eyes Wide Shut, because the great joke of Eyes Wide Shut is it's the comedy of constant interruption, yeah, right? And that's what makes Eyes Wide Shut a Buñuelian film, is in Buñuel, people can't leave, they can't sit down, they can't eat, they can't do things, they keep getting stopped. And Eyes Wide Shut, every 2 minutes, Tom Cruise is about to do something. It's like, oh shit, here's a phone call, you know? And The Master has a version of that. Yeah. And I think that Inherent Vice has also got a bit of that rhythm where, because he's investigating a crime, this is about, or a kidnapping or a disappearance or whatever. It's a parallel disappearance because it's Wolfman and Shasta. Right.
Yeah.
But he's also constantly being sidelined and detoured and interrupted and distracted. And all these different little narrative portals are being opened up. And he meets them to some extent in an unflappable way, or unflappable within the context of being constantly stoned, which is sort of like this weird deference to, well, fuck, I guess so, you know. And it again, it's one of those movies that I think uses that shaggy, and he is a shaggy dog of a person. Yes,
he is.
And Wolfman is a shaggy dog of a MacGuffin, because he's literally a were, you know, the werewolf name, you know, Mickey, yeah, Wolfman. But it's such a shaggy dog movie. He just kind of keeps kind of just missing what's in front of him. And of course, as you say, by the end, it's far less about the crime or the disappearance than about the loss of the lover and the acknowledgement that paradise is lost, I guess.
It's been paved over.
And that's that beautiful scene where he comes around the corner and sees the ridiculous curved tower over where he'd been in the rain with Shasta, yeah, before, which is a scene that on your podcast you covered, so we don't have to talk about it. But, you know, it's there in the DNA of the movie.
And, you know, I've been there, not to sound like Jake Gyllenhaal in Zodiac, I've been to that location. And, of course, not that there was ever, obviously, there was never an actual, a golden finger, but they have rebuilt the little, you know, the little alcove, the little entranceway where Doc and Shasta find shelter. That's been totally walled off. That little dip in the building is totally gone. There's a new facade that's been put in place there. Speaking of paved over paradise, I went to go visit that place and just kind of wanted to stand where, in that little entranceway where Doc and Shasta stood, and it's totally gone now. It's just a giant flat white wall
which seems very appropriate. Just like, you know, we were also there's a moment in your book where you take the time to focus on the moment where, and we've spoken about this as well, where Doc and the Golden Fang have their handoff, where he's hanging out with that perfectly Aryan family in front of the Macy's in North Hollywood. And it's such a wonderfully, wonderfully filmed and staged moment. And of course, earlier this year, that entire parking lot and that entire, that building were razed to the ground, destroyed and replaced with a giant condo/mini mall emporium that is the most glaring, disgusting eyesore. And just once again, just total eradication of what was to make room for a new parking lot.
They paved a parking lot. To put up an artificial paradise.
Yep. Which is just so vice-like and depressing. But speaking of your book, something else I wanted to talk about, which is one of the things I loved most is about it is how it explores PTA's films chronologically, and not chronologically in terms of their release into the world, but rather the periods of time in which the films are set. And in doing so, Vice gets contextualized or recontextualized so much as being so much more a piece of PTA's ongoing vision rather than seen as an outlier within it, which I think for a lot of people that who do think about this kind of nerdy shit, I do think that a lot of people view Inherent Vice as an outlier in his universe that's kind of orbiting around all of the other films, whereas you contextualize it by showing it as part of this chronological American narrative. You really frame his film as being part of his overall vision of characters trying to assert their nostalgia or hopes for what the world should be upon a canvas that's constantly disintegrating in front of their lives. We see Daniel Plainview doing that. We see Freddie Quell and Master both doing that to differing degrees. And then we come upon, and there's a very specific reason why you don't go directly from the Master to Phantom Thread to Vice, and we skip from, and I'll let readers of the book, or you can spoil it if you want, but I'll let readers of the book see that why that happens. But when you get to Vice, you realize that Doc, along with literally every other character in this film, is an avatar of that idea of these characters who are constantly trying to assert their want for the world, their vision for the world, their nostalgia for the world upon a world that is crumbling like wet sand in front of them, which again really reasserts what a hauntingly sad film Inherent Vice can be, and not just the Zucker Brothers goofballery of the trailer and of some genuine moments in the film. Just a truly sad film about how the world will never comport to your need for what you need it to be, that it is truly a world ruled by inherent vice. And when you contextualize it by that, you begin to see that all of PTA's films, the driving force, the kind of the motor in all of them, is the idea of a character versus the idea of inherent vice itself. And that's the nuclear core kind of a lot of his work. It's not just Bad Dads in the Valley.
No, it's not just Bad Dads in the Valley, but Bad Dads in the Valley works for that because there's that kernel of guilt or regret or transgression that's kind of, you know, eating away at them from the inside. I mean, there's that line in Magnolia that certainly not underquoted in either the movie or in studies of Anderson, but, you know, we may be through with the past, but the past isn't through with us. And there's a lot of meaning in that. I actually think in Magnolia specifically, its meaning is kind of banal. The way I think a lot of the big lines in that movie land a bit thuddingly, but the idea that you know, nostalgia is all about the past and expectation and memory and the things that we're told we're going to get when we grow up, those are all things that were kind of told in the past, and the past doesn't square with the present. The future is always out of reach. So a lot of the time his characters are kind of imploding from the inside. And I think what's interesting is those implosions or explosions were a big part of his early half of his career. I mean, right up to something like Punch Drunk Love, which is just all about a guy who can't contain his frustration anymore and, you know, just freaks out a lot. And casting Adam Sandler to play that guy is pretty brilliant. Yeah. I think that the feeling of loss of a larger psychogeographical mapping of loss, if not onto the whole country, then onto its extreme tip. You know, California is where you go to be as American as you can. It's like as far away as possible from the Atlantic Ocean and from the colonies and all that. You know, you just go to the other ocean. I think that that really starts in There Will Be Blood. And that's why starting the book with that movie, I don't want to use a word like daring, because people who describe themselves as daring, unless they're Evel Knievel, you know, probably shouldn't. But it was a risk, because by the whole thing with There Will Be Blood is it's like the reinvention of Anderson as a filmmaker, and really in some ways the final definitive embrace of him as this great formalist, where people who were doubting him for the first 10 years are now like, oh, this is clearly good. And it's so interesting to write about that movie without that evolution narrative behind it.
Sure.
It's like, what if this is the beginning? And I think that is such a, that movie works so well within its 2 hours and however many minutes as a move from an unblemished beginning to a horribly ruined end. But if you take that unblemished beginning, or that almost unblemished beginning, and put it as the primal scene of his whole body of work, I think it works.
Yeah,
I think the structure I chose starts to get a little fussy, where you're like, well, technically Boogie Nights is before Sydney or Heart Eight was made first. It's really weird to tell that story out of order, and then like Punch Drunk Love is kind of not really a historical movie at all. So you know, I think by the end, I hope it works, and I tried to make it work. But I mean, man, going back and having There Will Be Blood, The Master, and Inherent Vice is kind of like setting up his worldview. It works really well.
And it absolutely does. And I think it's actually kind of crucial to the understanding of his films, even though, you know, none of them were conceived to be, you know, I do think that PTA is an absolute, no pun intended, master filmmaker, but I don't think that he's such a master that, you know, he was hoping one day that people were going to unlock a structure where you're supposed to look at him this way. But it does so work within that context. And I think it, by removing them just from their simple running order, where you give them a very eight, where one can just give them a very 1 through 8. Okay, this film leads to this film leads to this film leads to this film. And, you know, everyone likes to look at that pivot from Punch Drunk to There Will Be Blood, as we've said, you know, the evolution from Coke Kid to Weed Dad, to strip the narrative of that and view the films alone and within that context of time itself, it reimagines all of them and allows you to view them in a totally different way. Even someone like me, who has watched Inherent Vice way too many times, there were so many moments when I was reading your chapter, I'm like, son of a bitch, he's right. And like, I would stumble upon something new. And again, I get really annoyed because you thought of it and I didn't. And there'd be these people like, this so disorders and reorders what I thought this film was. And I also think that it's crucial to keep, of the one thing to keep together in his filmography, to keep the kind of the triad of Blood, Master, and Vice as a kind of body of work that's whispering to each other, that the films are all kind of whispering to each other, I think is crucial, because I do think that those are the three films that most have a centralized figure projecting their ideas of what the world should be outward onto the world, and the world just kind of calmly saying back, no.
Yeah, well, no. They are movies in which the world kind of says no. And it's interesting too that in those three movies, and again, you know, I mean, we'll narrow things into Inherent Vice in a second when we do the scene, but it's interesting that in There Will Be Blood, Daniel Plainview is the character who's most least likely to take no for an answer. I mean, he ends up getting these rejections from fate and circumstance. And
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Duality, but you know, he really imposes himself. And Freddie is not so equipped to.
Yeah.
And Doc is not so equipped to. But it's interesting that where Daniel Plainview loses his strength by the end of the first movie is really commensurate with this kind of addiction that he has, where the addiction to drilling or the addiction to power and money in some ways is quite edifying, but alcohol kind of Like he becomes so imprecise. The way that he slurs and can't talk and he can't present himself in public anymore and retreats into this kind of alcoholic fugue. That's also really, really interesting in setting up both Freddie and the Master and Doc and Inherent Vice, who are characters who we're not seeing slip into that dependency, but they're kind of already in its grip when the movie starts. But I think the dependency in Inherent Vice is a bit mellower.
Well, obviously.
A bit.
And what's interesting is because these three men are all attempting the same thing, and albeit in extraordinarily different ways, to kind of project their ideas of what the world should be or what they want it to be or need it to be or hope it could be. They are also three men who, in the words of Mrs. Dodd, just can't take this world straight.
Yeah, it's a big line in Anderson's movies, a huge line. You can't take this world straight. Yeah.
And it's a heartbreaking line, and it's one that I think could be implied to just about every character in this film, and specifically the two characters who we find in today's scene.
Nicely done.
Give myself a clap. Let's do that. But that's exactly what this scene is. It's two men who one has already realized this, and I think the other is coming to realize that they just can't take this world straight.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, we are going to watch this scene and be right back, and we're going to talk about it.
Don't get up.
Bigfoot and he smashed on my door. Come on.
After a long and busy day of civil rights violations, I found myself in the neighborhood and compelled to drop in just to check and see the current state of affairs at my old stomping grounds, seeing as your effort to keep lines of communication had been limited, to say the least.
Well, I've been busy.
Trying to figure out which side of the zigzag paper is the sticky side. Give it to me. Listen, I'm sorry about last night. You? Why should you be sorry?
Weird. Are you okay, brother?
I'm not your brother.
How about you could use a keeper?
So, of the myriad of millions of things that I obviously find so fascinating about this film. One of them is the film's near perverse need to elide total understanding by its audience. You know, after climaxing from a plot perspective with this sweetly unambiguous return of Coy Harlingen to his family, which I think likely confused or surprised a lot of first-time viewers who, like Doc, because he is kind of representing us here. I think like Doc, we all thought the real story was going to be about the rescue of Mickey Wolfman and especially the return of Shasta Faye Hepworth. And the film kind of reveals to us, no, it was never about that. It was just about getting this guy home
and putting this one family together as the world falls apart around him. After that, after that one sweetly unambiguous moment, I am never not tickled that Inherent Vice more or less sighs its way to its closing credits with a trio of scenes that are increasingly opaque in their refusal to provide any kind of like clear or easily digestible meaning. There's the capture of the Golden Fang, the vessel, which happens in this, the capture of this avatar of ultimate evil, which takes place in this most offhand middle of a montage moment in which the film is almost can't be bothered to really stop to address that this is in any other movie would be the explosive like 15 minute finale. And even in Pynchon's book has a much longer sequence in which the Department of Justice is sending speedboats to chase after. And in the film, it's just like Doc and Sansa are like, so justice was done? Okay, cool. And then that slides obviously into this today's scene, the final encounter with Doc and Bigfoot, which doesn't take place in the book at all. And then Doc and Shasta riding out into the fog. And it's as if Anderson and the film can't help but remuddy the waters with ambiguity after giving us one purely and unambiguous moment. That there had to be, if that scene of Coy being returned to his family is the one unambiguous core idea in the film, everything around it has to begin to crumble. The center can't hold, and our understanding of it and the story must eventually give way and crumble into confusion again, as it can easily do in this moment where Bigfoot Bjornsson eats a whole goddamn tray of wheat. And so with that in mind, I'm curious, what did you think of this moment upon first seeing it? And how do you view it now? Because I do think this is one of those moments, this is one of the most thematically rich and one of the most prismatic in that you can go, I think, about 25 different ways with how you view what happens here.
Yeah, I saw Inherent Vice for the first time at, I think, the Warner Brothers screening room on the outskirts of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And Warner,
right? Yeah, it's Warner Brothers movie. Making sure
I'm not false memories. And it was a small little screening room, but a big screen. And it was one of those for your consideration screenings where they'll have them at like 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on the same day, so they're not that crowded. And I have very strong recall of seeing that scene for the first time and just being completely broken by Brolin's acting, broken in the sense of laughing because he's very funny.
Yeah.
But also when his face empties out, I think in the book I describe him as something like, Jack, he's like Dragnet, he's like Jack Webb, but like Jack Webb becoming Frank Serpico or something. The way that this cartoonish performance melted into sort of just total anguish and this feeling of loss. And the one character in the movie who's kind of got the solidity of a brick wall,
yeah,
and who he acts with the solidity of a brick wall, is crumbling a bit. And even divorced from really an interpretive response to it the first time, just being very affected by that on just a level of like, if Bigfoot's falling apart.
What does that mean for the rest of us? That great line you had is you wrote that his face has become a devastated landscape to rival Lancaster Dodds at the end of The Master, right down to the flickers of desperate surrender in his eyes, as if Jack Webb had become momentarily possessed by Frank Serpico, which I am going to throw in there just because that's such a great goddamn line. I had to say it aloud.
But then more generally, you think of The Master because it's this final confrontation between two characters who seem in a way to sync. It's just that in The Master, he doesn't go so far as to actually have them sync their dialogue together. And again, I have to be careful to not go too deep into The Master, which is a movie that I love. And that scene with Slow Boat to China is misinterpreted, I think, even by some very smart people, as a Hail Mary, like a way out of the movie, when it's actually just the end of a thread that's run through the whole movie.
Yeah.
About seamanship and wandering and possessiveness and what it means to have somebody to yourself alone, both for Dodd, but also for Freddie.
Yeah. And to be wanted.
Pardon me?
And to be wanted. That be I, wanted. That, and but
you had a great line in nine. Now we're going into total master territory, but whatever. It's a podcast on Hair and Vice. We can talk about whatever we want.
Yeah.
The idea that you expressed of the tear rolling down Freddie's cheek in the love and appreciation of being wanted, but also the knowledge that the understanding that that doesn't mean that that's enough for you to have to stay.
Yeah.
Which I do think is very much in keeping with Inherent Vice.
I think it is too. And I think that, you know, in The Master also this idea that the song comes out of Dodd, because he's someone we see sing. He's a showman. Yeah. He's a performer. I mean, in a way it's an insane moment, but it's in keeping. Yeah. And I think that at the end of Inherent Vice, what's interesting is that in a way Bigfoot doesn't stay true to what we've seen. There is the one thing we never thought would happen. Like, we're aware with it, and this is Pynchon. It's not just Anderson. I mean, it's Pynchon, the wary resentment and respect between them and the way that they represent the individual and the institution. But there's this kind of common understanding that even though they're both investigating the same people, there's no crossover between them. And you would never, ever see Doc move consciously or unconsciously to be more like Bigfoot.
Sure.
But that scene to me is all about Bigfoot moving, I think, against every rational impulse he has. But in light of what he's learned about the Golden Fang and the death of his partner and his understanding of the world, he wants to be more like Doc.
Oh, 100%.
Or even if he doesn't want to be more like Doc, he's compelled to understand how the other half lives. And in a way, and I'm not trying to overstate the case, but the scene is a bit of a vindication of Doc's principle, because he doesn't change. And Bigfoot, I think, who lives by principles and law and by the book, and, you know, I mean, even when he breaks the law or nudges the law, it's in the service of his calling.
Yeah.
Those principles don't hold. And it's not like you can reduce the scene to saying, hey, the cop wants to be a hippie. I mean, if you say it out loud like that, it's bad. But it's more about the this pull, this demagnetizing of Bigfoot's own moral compass or ethical compass, and how it leads him a little bit towards this guy he hates and resents. And when you get that idea of wanting to be the thing that you've abused, the movie opens up. It opens up emotionally. It opens up sexually. It opens up in all homoerotically. It opens up in all kinds of ways when they are synced together like that.
Exactly. And that it's kind of shocking that this scene is not in the book, because it feels like such a necessity and such, you know, if we're talking about climaxes and, you know, Coy being the scene with Coy returning to his family kind of being the surprise climax of the plot that we didn't know was actually the plot. I feel like emotionally very much so, this scene is a necessary climax to the thread of feelings in the film, and the thematic and emotional threads that wind through the film. And also it is kind of the necessity or the necessary conclusion to the arc of Doc and Bigfoot, because, you know, you mentioned in your Vice chapter that Doc kind of has two funhouse mirrors to his personality in this film. There's Coy Harlingen, which is the man he could be were he to choose a life that had a hearth and a home in it. And that's one way his life can go, but another way that Doc's life could very much go, because he is a man whose heart has been squashed beneath the boot of Inherent Vice, is to become embittered by that loss and unsure of where to go next or who to love or even how. And obviously that mirrored connection is then finally amplified by this moment where they are facing each other like two reflections and literally say the exact same thing. You know, listen, I'm sorry about last night. Why do you have to be sorry? It's weird. But I think that where this scene so pays off and works on that great Inherent Vice level, where it can just be something, like you said, the first time you were watching it, you're just able to laugh at it, and you don't have to dig for any kind of deeper underpinnings or meanings, even though you can sense that there's something there. But then when you watch it more and you dig into it more, I find this to be one of the most heartbreaking moments of the film, because as much as they can be funhouse mirror reflections of each other, I think there's something totally, and as you said, maybe it's just the surety of morality that Doc has in himself. There's something totally missing from Bigfoot that isn't quite gone from Doc yet. And I don't know if it's hope or if it's love or it's just a moral code that Doc will not slide from that Bigfoot, you know, plays a little faster and looser. But while both they both have Freddie Quill's "You Can't Take This World Straight" disease, there's something about the voraciousness of Bigfoot's consumption that is so different from Doc's. Even though Doc's is very steady, there's
he's making up for lost hedonism.
Well, and not just that. It's that idea of, you know, this is kind of the climax to this running thread throughout the film, whether it's eating the bananas that phallically resemble his dead partner, or the pancakes that represent his mother's love and respect, or here the pot that, you know, I agree with you. I don't think that Bigfoot wants to be a hippie. I do think, though, he wants to be the hero of this story, yet knows he cannot. He's the guy that had to outsource vengeance for his partner's murder to the hippie that he can't stand a lot of the time. It's as if Bigfoot understands his role in this story and hates it. And so he's trying to absorb what he can't be.
Well, for sure. And to develop the mirror thing between them too. I mean, it's what you say, I say in the book. I mean, we obviously agree. We are sinking like the characters. You know, he could have been Coy as a family man. And if he's embittered, he could be Bigfoot. But the other way in which he could be Bigfoot is that they are both in a professional, licensed way. I mean, they're investigators.
Yeah.
That's, again, the difference between something like Lebowski, where the dude is an accidental Seamus, right? Yeah. I mean, the thing about Doc is, you know, I mean, he doesn't belong to a union and he barely has an office. But he doesn't get paid, but like his job is to do right by the world.
Yeah.
And Bigfoot is someone who I think, as an LAPD officer, you just by saying those four letters, you're like, oh, both in a movie context and a real world context, he's probably an asshole. But, you know, he styles himself like one of those upstanding 50s detectives. I mean, I didn't mention Jack Webb and Dragnet by accident, right?
Yeah.
And in the 70s, when this movie is taking place, just down the street in San Francisco, you have a guy like Harry Callahan and Dirty Harry, who represents, you know, Bigfoot if his facade never broke. You know, Dirty Harry just internalizes that bitterness to the point where it's kind of what drives him. But yeah. he'd never take a dive into the weed bowl or, you know, cry in front of a hippie. He'd actually just violate that hippie's civic rights and beat the shit out of him more. But Bigfoot is first shown in the movie, and you'll know if I'm wrong, because you've done an obsessive podcast and I just wrote a chapter. I mean, one of the first times we see Bigfoot is in hippie drag.
The very first time.
On TV. Yeah, very first time.
What's
which
up,
suggests
Doc?
That, we, with What's Up, Doc, which suggests a kind of play acting in this garb.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of the scene much later on. So it can't be an influence on Anderson, but it's getting at some of the same things. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when DiCaprio, as this Western star, is being dressed by the costume designer to look Manson-ish, even before Manson is the thing.
Yeah.
We know that he looks like Charles Manson. No one knows who Charles Manson is yet because the movie is before the murders. But it's all about an aesthetic that is also about something in the air and about a generation changing. And the reason that I mentioned Serpico is because by the 70s, that's kind of what movie cops are. You know, with the exception of Dirty Harry at one extreme, you know, movie cops and the idea of cops are these people who can't live with the guilt, with the inherent vice of their jobs and what they're really serving and the crisis of authority in America at the beginning of the 70s. Like, how do you represent law and order when you're working for fucking Richard Nixon? You know, like, you either lean into it or you're repulsed by it. And I don't think Anderson was sitting with a checklist thinking of all that stuff, but it informs what is happening in that scene. The counterculture doesn't yearn for authority, but authority, which is only made up of people, there's a moment where he's like, oh shit, you know,
where do I go from here? What am I supposed to do next?
And I think it's in line, now just speaking more generally about Anderson, with the abundance of empathy that the guy has as a filmmaker, which can sometimes seem undisciplined and out of control and embarrassing. It's not for nothing that this is the one moment in Inherent Vice, maybe not the weed eating, but the tearful staring. It's like something from Magnolia.
It's a moment of total recognition of someone's pain.
Recognition, empathy, pain. I wouldn't say the majority of Inherent Vice is keyed to that exact emotional frequency. It's different.
Yeah.
But this is the Anderson who kind of wants everybody in a way to have their catharsis, which is what a movie like Magnolia is about, where it will literally stop and demolish the fourth wall on several occasions so you can see people crying. And I'm not saying that in a belittling way. I'm just saying that's what that movie is.
And this is, you know, I've said it on this show before, and it's not like this is an original idea by any means, but you know PTA is kind of the child, you know, everyone calls him, you know, the son of Scorsese and Altman and such, but like he's such a Jonathan Demme-esque director and such an acolyte of Demme in that his films are just infused with this almost cosmic level of humanism, that this undeniable humanism and love for his characters, with maybe the exception of Jimmy Gator, and yet despite that humanism, which I do feel like this is a deeply humanist film, I think that you are right in which there are very few moments in which an Inherent Vice in which that feeling is so unabashed as it is right here in this moment, where we literally have our hero, our surrogate, us, crying. And at first you're the first time you watch it, which is again one of the great things about this film, is how it can play on different levels. The first time you watch it, it's kind of a laugh that he's crying, because he's crying because someone's eating his weed. Like he's like, whoa, this cop that could kick his ass. So, you know, Bigfoot can't do anything to stop him. He's just eating his weed. And, you know, Doc was just settling in for a nice afternoon of getting high after a hard week's work, battling the Golden Fang, missing Shasta and returning Coy.
Yeah.
But he's not just crying because Bigfoot is copiously eating his entire tray of weed. He's crying because he's recognizing, oh shit, this guy whose balls I've been busting the whole time, and, you know, having these little tete-a-tetes with, he is so goddamn irretrievably broken. And as I said, the great coda to this sequence, you know, when he says, "Are you okay, brother?" And of course, Bigfoot, as much as he maybe wants to, cannot respond to that empathy with anything other than disdain, and that, you know, that slate face Easter Island head of Brolin's looking at him, just saying, you know, "I'm not your brother." And maybe the most humanist statement in this film or any others of PTA's, "No, but you could use a keeper." And Doc recognizing, and in a way, I think that's Doc both recognizing Bigfoot's pain and also maybe recognizing what Doc's role is in this world overall, this world that that he's continually tried to see as a playground for he and Shasta's love and where they're supposed to come back together. It's almost like a recognition, and maybe I'm reaching, but again, this is a podcast about Inherent Vice, that it's almost Doc recognizing his own place, that he's Doc as a keeper, you know, Jules at the end of Pulp Fiction, he's got to be a shepherd.
Well, you took the word out of my mouth. I was going to say, we were almost synced. We almost said it at the same time. And it's funny because in Pulp Fiction, when Jackson says that, you know, "I'm trying real hard to be a shepherd," there's the inherent comic strain. And, you know, and whether that's Tarantino just like admitting his love of genre, or the ferociousness of Jackson's performance being racially coded in a way that's very presumptuous by Tarantino, which I think is one of his big problems when he uses Jackson. But like when he says, "I'm trying real hard to be a shepherd," the emphasis is like, this isn't going to last. You know, these guys better get out of this diner. I mean, Jules is not chill. But
he's one step away from murdering everyone in this room. So,
and that the emphasis is on the effort. But you get a sense in Inherent Vice that actually wanting to be someone's keeper, and that's a multifaceted word, keeper, because keeper can also connote, you know, ownership and possessiveness.
With his relationship to Shasta.
With Shasta. But, you know, I think being a keeper kind of comes easily to him. And it's something that Freddy and the Master is incapable of.
Yeah.
Freddy can barely look after himself, but the triumph of the Master at the end is he kind of does.
Yeah.
I mean, the Master is all about someone realizing that he's not a kept object. It doesn't have to be. And, you know, there's true freedom at the end of that, even though you get the sense maybe at the end he's always going to be trapped by his fetishes and always going to be trapped by his wants. He's a free agent in a different way than before he met Master. In Inherent Vice, I think Doc really wants to protect. And in a way, maybe what he doesn't protect is himself.
That's the thing that's always put in hazard and put at risk, to be someone, as we see throughout the film. Doc is constantly putting himself at hazard, you know, to use a line from a film that competed a lot with There Will Be Blood, which is No Country for Old Men, when, you know, Tommy Lee Jones says, you know, if you're really going to try to do some good in this world, you have to be willing to put your soul at hazard. And that's exactly what Doc is, you know, that's part of the Shaggy Dog detective story, is you have to have a, quite literally, a knockabout detective and its sender getting knocked about left and right like a pinball by all of these other forces. And that's kind of what Doc does, is he's always putting himself at risk for a cause that he finds worthy. He literally is risking, in the latter half of this film, he's risking his life, you know, to basically make sure this one bad dad from the valley, not quite the valley, this one bad dad from Pasadena gets back together with his family and is willing to put everything at risk for that.
And isn't it lovely how Anderson films him in that scene, returning coy?
He doesn't come in. No.
Which is very much like The Searchers, right? Where you can't go in the door.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You can bring the family together. I mean, it's like The Searchers in reverse. It's not returning the daughter to the father. It's returning the father to the daughter. Right. There's a lot less at stake because, you know, Coy is not an architect of the American West. He's kind of just like a dude, which is why he's well played by Owen Wilson. I mean, Owen Wilson's sweet spot is just dude.
Wow.
But that was a good impression. But he can't be part of the reunion. It's not his family. He doesn't have one, which is why. And it's not to step on your final increment, because you'll have someone for the last increment of this podcast. But, you know, I'm pretty sure the scene with Bigfoot, whether it's fantasy or not, it's two people who are there and present. Mm-hmm. I am not so sure about the last scene. Both in the relationship to the source text, whereas we do know Doc drives off alone.
Yeah, hoping the fog will reveal something better.
The fog will reveal something. And here, Anderson, he loves, in Punch Drunk Love, The Master, this, and Phantom Thread. He's got boy and girl together.
Yeah.
This is the one where I am least certain that is true. But you may want to get into that with a different guest.
Isn't that kind of the point? Isn't that uncertainty? That uncertainty,
sure.
You know, both on a thematic but also literal level, we can't be sure. You know, on a thematic level, we can't be sure that they'll ever end up together, riding off into the sunset or the fog, because of the nature of the relationship. You know, as Doc even puts it, this doesn't mean we're back together. But even also, literally, you can't be sure that she's in the car. You can't know,
because we've spent a whole movie with Joanna Newsom,
Sorlise, yeah,
as a sixth sense type character who, again, I'm not totalizing a reading of Inherent Vice where it's like he has imaginary friends. I mean, that's dumb. But she doesn't interact with anybody else. I mean, she's just there for him. And in the sense that she's the voice of the book, you know, there's a sense, I think, in which she's one kind of dream girl, which is she's an externalization of his consciousness. She's there to help him. She has no agency of her own. She's really just kind of there to be Doc's...
Jiminy Cricket. His keeper.
And by the end of the movie, she's not there anymore. Shasta's there, and I'm not sure that that's replacing one thing for something more substantial. It may just be more of the same. But anyway,
as a final beta, you even note in the book, and maybe I was overreading into it, there's almost an ominousness at play in the sacrifice for a wise, a potentially imaginary wise voice of wisdom to, again, a potentially imaginary sacrificing that wisdom to just daydream the way you want things to be and going back to just almost re-succumbing, kind of, as you said, like Freddy at the end of The Master, re-succumbing to his own fetishes and desires. That circularity and that circuitousness, you can wonder if Doc leaves this moment here wanting to be a keeper, wanting to make the effort to be the shepherd with someone who is equally lost, and then just losing him almost because there's no one to be a keeper for him, losing himself in his ideas and his nostalgia and getting back into that fog of where he wants to be. And because there's no one there to catch him, and sacrificing what he knows to be maybe the better angel of his nature in the form of Sorlige, to just go back to, no, I want to be in the car with Shasta Fey. That's where I want. That's what I want. And that's where I need to be headed. No matter what, like, I just want to get back into the car.
To return to our increment briefly, because you mentioned No Country and it seemed like a good end to do this. I mean, just to talk about Brolin, I mean, I'm sure over the course of this podcast, I know that you have, you know, he comes up because he has his scenes and
MVP of the film to me, MVP.
They're funny scenes. But what a sudden persuasive case he made for kind of major American actor there over a period pretty late.
Yeah, late in the game. And that it's almost like he emerged from nowhere or from nothingness, totally reformed as this avatar of American masculinity and performance.
He's a pretty reliably interesting and in his weird way, kind of unpredictable actor.
It was not scripted that he was going to eat this plate of like dump the entire tray of weed. That was an ad lib on his part where he kept pushing PTA saying, I think he has to go for it. He has to go for the whole thing. He can't just eat the roach. He's got to go for all of it.
Yeah.
And PTA and his trust of actors is like, well, okay. I mean, if that's what you want to do, we'll do a take.
Yeah. I mean, it's, he's such a seemingly predictable, easily legible actor because he's got the chiseled looks.
Yeah.
And he's got this really erect posture and, you know, he's quite handsome, but he's really, really good at playing people with these just little shivers of, shivers of uncertainty or clumsiness to them. Like I think of the part in Milk, which he was actually Oscar nominated for as the assassin, Harvey Milk. And he's just this guy who seems to dread kind of what he's capable of, but he doesn't show it to anybody. He barely shows it to the audience, but it's just enough. And I think that in his part here as Bigfoot, you're so enjoying his physical comedy and his bullying and his kind of crew cut and all the stuff that you talked about. But at the same time, it's not like the emotion comes out of nowhere. It's coded into the acting. He's very, very smart the way he plays Bigfoot, I think, because there's that frustration. It's the frustration of someone who can't express how sad he is, so it comes out as mean.
Exactly. And the way you described his character in Milk is as a man who dreads what he is capable of. I feel like that's something you see in almost all of his, you know, post-resurgence performances. But I also think that is something that is definitively Bigfoot, a man who dreads, not so much a man who dreads what he is capable of. Bigfoot is a man who dreads what he is capable of feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Who dreads what he's capable of feeling, and who functions quite invulnerably as a sight gag because we're laughing at him, but within the world of the movie, no one dares laugh at him.
Yeah,
I mean that's the thing when he's sucking on the chocolate banana and stuff. That's like a very like 12-year-old boy sight gag. I mean, it's not sophisticated humor. It's really kind of.
And yet,
because Doc can't react to it because of the power dynamic, you know,
that makes him look at him sidelong or in the moment when Bigfoot's like, no Cielo Drive for Bigfoot. No, Doc literally has to lower his face to not let Bigfoot see that he's trying to laugh. Like as much as Bigfoot or as much as Doc will mock him, he can't show it because he's terrified of what Bigfoot's reaction would be.
But even in the name Bigfoot, and this is obviously Pynchon, not Anderson, that idea of something primal underneath this kind of system of laws and rules and protocol, you know, it's simian, it's ape-like. And that's why it's so funny. I mean, one of the movie's last cartoon effects, its last slapstick effect is him kicking in the door like Lou Ferrigno, you know, which is pretty funny. It's a ridiculous moment. I mean, I have to look at the scene again, but it's not like very physically convincing. It's like he's just like crashing into a set.
It's an afterthought. Like it's just, it's like a paper mache door that he just is able to blow down and walk right past. It's what a perfect.
And the way that at that point within the film, nothing startles Doc anymore.
He's just frustrated. He's like, Bigfoot, you kicked down my door.
The door, yeah.
Now like just funny, narrating what happens in frustration.
That's some funny shit.
That's how you should have closed out that chapter, by the way. Some funny shit. Oh, speaking of closing out, on that note, I gotta say thank you so much for making time for this today, for coming on. I highly recommend by the time this episode drops,
It will be out in stores, online, indie bookshops, where you should be getting it. Paul Thomas Anderson, Masterworks. It is an amazing encapsulation of the beginning to the, hopefully just the midpoint of PTA's career, from Sydney or Heartache to Phantom Thread, but reorganized and recontextualized in a way that is both really surprising and really interesting and just very, very satisfying.
No, that's really kind. And I'll see you inevitably for my podcast, which is just going to be called Vice Increments, where we're just going to go through Adam McKay's film Vice.
Oh, my God.
You know, in scene by scene. And then at the end of each installment, the guest blows their brains out after describing their least favorite scene.
Oh, my God. That's a good note to close on. But before we roll out, do me a favor. Tell everyone listening where they can find you and your work online.
I'm on Twitter at BroFromAnother. I write often for The Ringer as, I guess, a regular freelancer. You can always find me in CinemaScope, write sometimes for Reverse Shot. And in terms of the book, let's just say Amazon's not the first place that I would suggest ordering from. You can order from bookshelf.org. You can order from a local bookstore who should be able to get it. Certainly, you can order it from the Abrams website. But yeah, the book is out. Well, by the time people hear this, it'll be out. It comes out October 20th. And I hope people enjoy it. It's a big, colorful visual production that, even though there's like 70,000 words of text, if people end up judging it by its cover, I won't be sad, because the people at Little Red Lodge did a beautiful job just making it. So yeah, I hope this ends up in someone's hands as a result of this podcast. And I just couldn't have had a better time. So thank you.
Thank you. And again, remember, you don't have to buy the book from the Golden Fang if you don't want to. You can go to an indie bookseller.
Yeah.
And again, thank you for coming on today. Thank you to everyone out there for listening. And you'll see me and hear me next time, where myself and a very special guest are going to ride out into the fog together.
Oh, Bigfoot. You poor Flintstone flat-topped bastard. If anyone could make us love such a hippie-hating mad dog as yourself, it's PTA. But now what? What's left for us to say? Or Doc and Shasta to do? Sortilege says everything comes to an end. But does it really? Well, I guess we'll see what we can see next time on Increment Vice.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.